Counterspin Media presents The Right to Truth with William Bissett.
Now, you must know things are very wrong right now. The biggest threat to New Zealand is being rolled out in our suburbs and rolled out through our cities. The biggest threat to New Zealand at the moment is actually being endorsed and implemented by our own councils. Sounds dramatic, but in a sense we're at war. We're at war with the World Economic Forum, who through the councils are wanting to implement smart cities. Now, before you roll your eyes, smart cities are a huge problem. They're completely going to strip away our democracy, our freedoms. In fact, the purpose of this video is to educate you, because we need education on what exactly smart cities are. The smart city system fundamentally means we're going to be in a digital prison. The potential of them to fine us, to tax us if we go outside our boundaries, is going to introduce digital ID, digital currency, social credit system, which is going to severely penalise us if we go against the narrative. So it's really important that you spend this time to learn about smart cities and how it's going to impact you. And together as a community, we must work out ways of how can we stop this. It is important that we stop this, for not only for ourselves, but also for our children. So I'm really pleased to have Ross here. Ross, thank you very much for coming in. You've done a huge amount of research on smart cities. You've traveled, you've given talks, you've interviewed a whole lot of people about the smart city systems. If I could just dislocate the conversation and start off with a solution. And the solution to stop the smart cities is to get rid of the 5G system. Would that be a fair enough comment?
I think we first of all need to connect as a community and understand that there are some issues. At the moment, fifth generation technology, as you say, is actually coming in at an incredible rate. And we have base units in every suburb in Christchurch, just as an example. People don't realize how it could be misused against the people in terms of control and inventory, which, as you say, could result in the application of a social credit system that would penalize people in what they can actually do in the name of sustainable behavior.
This is just a quick interruption, guys. Now look, to help Counterspin continue to deliver you high quality and really well-researched content, I'm going to help by raising funds by offering you exclusive discounts on high quality products to help your health. For example, the Oxy drink. Now the Oxy drink is the only device in the world that we could find to deliver over 2,000 milligrams of pure medical grade oxygen into the water. So it's a super oxygenated system. Now, it's been clinically proven that super oxygenated water can be absorbed 10 times faster than any other system. It gets absorbed through your digestive tract into your blood. So by increasing oxygenation in the blood, it works on every single system of your body, including to help restore cellular function by recharging the ATP or the mitochondria in your cells. The health benefits are quite impressive. In fact, look at our website. There's over 32 health benefits listed, along with links to medical studies. Now, we've not found anything as good as this, and especially for the price that you pay. Now, talking about the price, exclusive to you, exclusive to this show, you're going to get $100 off and free shipping. Now, that's free shipping in New Zealand. We can send it to all around the world, but there will be an additional cost outside of New Zealand. So not only will you get $100, but the Counterspin Media Project will also receive $100 as well, which is pretty impressive. So if you're interested in this, don't dilly-dally, because to be quite honest, they're actually selling quite quickly anyway. We do have a limited stock. We do have more stock coming in, but the price is definitely going up after that. So if you think you're interested, use the links, make sure you use the discount codes, and thank you for watching. Because the core need to have a proper smart city system is the 5G network. Is that correct?
Well, the real name, the full name, if you want to call it that, for smart cities is Smart Carbon Dioxide Free 15-Minute Cities. So once we understand the meaning of smart, which basically is the fifth generation technology, the Internet of Things, carbon dioxide free essentially refers to the science, which should be questionable, as everything should be. We should be able to look at things with open eyes And we should be able to look at the climate science that underlies this, which leads us to the necessity of sustainable behaviour. And 15-minute cities is a model that basically is being brought in around the world in the name of reducing people's non-sustainable behaviour, such that they take active and passive sustainable transport mechanisms. So they're literally active means cycling or walking, passive means taking public transport, and that everything that they need within the 15-minute city, which is basically cut up into villages, is within 15 minutes of cycling, walking, or taking public transport in terms of where they live. So the idea is, once we understand the terminology, we understand things like, I suppose, citizen engagement, which is getting us on board essentially with a plan that most of us don't yet know about. So the terminology is really important. We have to get our heads around a lot before we can actually make an informed decision as a community.
Well, that's what this video is all about. Now, on the surface of things, the smart city appears to be a reasonably good idea because they're using lots of buzzwords about climate change, safety, conveniences, and it's pictured as this utopia, perfect way of living. And so a lot of people, you know, may actually be on board with this. So let's start at the very beginning. What does a smart city look like and what's its potential?
Well, we have a partnership city under the Smart Cities Council, and it's influenced through the Association of Local Government Information Management and the Smart Cities Council Australia and New Zealand, which sit essentially providing information to our councils, all councils in New Zealand. We have a scenario where we are partnered in Christchurch, for example, where we're living, with Vitoria Gasteiz in Spain. So this would be very much along the lines of the utopia that you talk about. So our council have actually been across, we have representatives who've gone across to Vitoria Gasteiz in Spain, and they have been shown this smart city. Obviously, it exists where it has fifth generation technology. In other words, the Internet of Things is in operation. It has the 15-minute cities model, which literally is, as we explained, we are being encouraged not to use personal cars. We are, by 2050, the goal in New Zealand is to basically have us out of personal cars by 2050, which would reduce the roll toll to zero. Obviously, if you haven't got a car, you're not likely to have an accident. The reality is that in Vitoria Gasteiz, everyone lives in fundamentally the same size apartment. No one has a garden. There's no communal ground in terms of food resource. There's no communal gardens, community gardens. There is a road network that involves very little available parking. So if you had a car, you couldn't easily move between the different villages within Vitoria Gasteiz. And the idea is that with your village, you would move using active sustainable behaviour. So again, we're getting used to the terminology where you walk or cycle. The road network has cycleways, as we're beginning to find on our roads in Christchurch, all over the place, which is not a bad thing. It's great that we can cycle. And this is where people get a little bit drawn in by what we're calling traffic calming measures. So according to our council, if we talk to them directly, the people who are actually making these decisions for us without our knowing,
which you've talked to yourself.
Who I have talked to myself, mm-hmm. They tell us that the traffic calming measures, which include massively reduced speed limits, roadworks, speed bumps, priority for public transport, cyclists and walkers at junctions, as you'll start to notice, the traffic flow is not easy. The imposition of basically making it very difficult for us to move across town. And so when I talked to a particular person at the council, they were telling me that they're making it as difficult as possible to drive across town on purpose to slowly push people away from the use of personal cars. Now, of course, the reality is in New Zealand, we have all sorts of reasons for using a personal car. And so if we knew this and we realized that the Christchurch rebuild wasn't about making Christchurch accessible for people, but making it as difficult as possible to drive across Christchurch, then we would really intelligently be looking at the climate science that underlies all these necessities of slowly taking us away from private car use. Now, in Vitoria Gasteiz, they don't have a smart car program. And our council, speaking to those who went across, were surprised at this. The reality is, in my understanding, it is not envisaged that we will have any car in terms of personal use by 2050 if we allow this program to continue. So it's smart, it's carbon dioxide free, which relates to a digital currency, as you say. And the digital currency is designed to come in over the next few years. It could be much sooner than later. We're already watching as high street banks are disappearing, cash tills are disappearing. The use of cash is actually becoming more and more restrained. And people are paying using their apps on their phones, obviously card use, and FPOS is certainly an interesting point of sale technology. It's certainly an interesting thing as we develop a carbon dioxide allowance for each transaction, which has already been tested in England using the same system under NatWest, where you're given a carbon dioxide allowance for each transaction. So basically, at this stage in England included, it's not actually being forced on you. It's not something that if you use a lot of carbon dioxide in terms of your transactions that you can't do something as a result yet. But the reality is, if this system is introduced and we have the carbon dioxide allowances for each transaction, and as they had under NatWest, you have a sustainable alternative to your transaction. So instead of buying petrol, you could have taken the bus. The reality is that our actions are being slowly drawn into what they call sustainable behavior based on climate science. So that sustainable behavior is being conditioned, and that's called nudge theory. So we have a nudge unit in New Zealand, as they have a nudge unit in England. And so it's creating our behavioral patterns using conditioning based on the fear of climate change.
Hi guys, just another quick interruption with another offer. Now, clip a little bit of your hair and send it to the Brylin Functional Medicine Centre. This is where we can scan your hair for energetic imbalances and then send you back a corresponding remedy. Now, in layman's terms, it's kind of like a lie detector. It's going to ask your body thousands of questions about what is energetically imbalanced. When I say a lie detector, it's not going to tell me if you've jumped the fence and did some naughtiness with your neighbour. What it's going to do is going to tell me lots of information, for example, the hormone profile, the blockages in your back, sensitivities to foods, heavy metals, chemical toxicities, is that cell talking to that cell properly, are the electrons spinning? It gives a lot of information you don't actually need to know, but the key thing is it makes a perfectly balanced remedy to help nudge you back energetically in the right direction. Now, what the offer is that you're going to get $50 off if you use the discount code in the links below, and Counterspin Media Project will get 100% of the proceeds. That's right, they'll get 100% of the proceeds. Now, I can only allocate this for one person per week. So first in, first serve, use the links below and the discount codes. Thanks for watching.
And this is why we're seeing this constant rollout of climate change problems, and I see even some officials are saying, you know, climate change is causing increased health conditions, and so it's, you know, creating this whole fear. And so
I'll just say one thing in there. There was actually an interesting article in the press, which of course does have a lot of questionable articles in my view about climate science, and they had an article the other day about the missing link, which was an animal that supposedly looks very much like an orangutan, but basically it was deemed by the article to have died out based on its inability to deal with climate change at the time that it was around. And obviously they made the point that orangutans themselves are still here because they did adapt to the climate change at the time. So the reality is we find articles which are conditioning us to believe that climate science is a real issue to deal with. We have many people basically taking actions, pressure groups, people sitting in the middle of roads around the world believing in climate science without really having questioned it, because we're told you can't really question this. So when you look back to the Iron Mountain report of 1967, where the issues were first drawn to public attention, we need to understand that there may be interested groups which also are now starting to become a little bit more obvious as people start to question the actions of organizations like the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, obviously, as you mentioned earlier, and the World Health Organization.
So what do you think the motivation is behind all this?
Well, this is where I focus on what we can know. And what we can know is what's absolutely transparently not true. We cannot fully know the motivations. As a result, we look at things that seem to be happening in terms of the Belt and Road Initiative that Jacinda has signed us up to when she was in power.
Those who are not aware of that, can you just expand on that a little bit?
The Belt and Road Initiative is primarily Chinese funded. It's trillions and trillions of dollars behind it, and it basically is a new Silk Road, which would be in operation around the world in terms of migration and production in terms of moving things around the world with respect to what we're looking at as a new regional setup around the world, where we would be fundamentally in what we call the South Pacific region. So again, it's covering a topic that when we start to look at it on a local level, we're looking in the smart cities model with the 15-minute cities of things like urban densification, and where people start to see the housing that is now taking place on Christchurch streets, as an example. It's happening in every under every council. But when we start to see buildings that are built with no available parking, where we're looking at buildings with maybe one available parking space for a whole household that live in a building where there are more than one household. So the idea is slowly the technology that we're experiencing, which is the fifth generation technology, which basically is a monitoring controls inventory system. We're looking at things like automatic number plate recognition, retinal recognition, and all sorts of things that work in conjunction with the smart modules that then go onto the LED streetlight system that form part of the fifth generation technology. And of course, what we're looking at is the Internet of Things, which, as wonderfully sounding as they make it, as the telcos make it sound, where literally we'll walk towards our house and our house will be a smart house, of course, where the door recognizes who we are and opens for us. The heating is set to what we would want it set to. And almost when we think of what we want music-wise or environment-wise, our environment is conditioned for our benefit. The reality is through what we see as fifth generation technology inventory and control, including our water, for example, our energy usage. The reality is we're increasingly being monitored. And in that monitoring, we could lose a lot of rights and freedoms.
And when it comes to rights and freedoms, the problem I guess we're in is once we're in this digital prison, once we have social credit, digital IDs, and digital currency, if the government can then say, right, well, if you want to use your bank account, you must be vaccinated, for example. Or because you made that comment on Facebook, we're switching off your accounts and you no longer have permission to go and do this. Or if you're purchasing too much meat.
Yeah.
So, of course, by 2030, they want to actually stop all meat production anyway.
Again, we can't know fully the motives, as we've discussed already. The reality is when we look at the idea that we have to get carbon dioxide down to a certain level, methane down to a certain level, and we look at cattle, for example, as being the primary source of methane excess in our environment, if that's a problem, of course, we're not allowed really as a population to question this. The reality is that the only way of reducing that methane output is to cull the cattle. So again, as you say, there seems to be a move away from meat eating. But where the motives are not known, of course, what we're looking at is this for our benefit? And so when we can only understand what is happening from a compartmentalized viewpoint, we're limited to what we can question. So in talking to a particular member of the Christchurch City Council who was basically playing a fairly major part in what has been going on to this point, in terms of he went over to Vittoria Gasteiz, among other council people. He said to me, it really doesn't matter about the science, because what we're doing is right for the people, even if the people don't know what's right for them. Now, the reality is traffic calming measures, as an example, need to be something that are openly discussed with an open forum where we can look at why we're being, basically, it's being enforced on us that we're going to find it more difficult to drive across Christchurch as these traffic calming measures are enforced. So I I've mentioned before at talks I've given that among these traffic calming measures in my research, I talked to a police officer who'd been into the council because he found himself in Victoria Street in Christchurch, and he was looking at the lighting system, you know, the red lights, the junctions, and basically he could see that the sequencing was not advantageous to the public in moving around Christchurch more efficiently. So he went into the council, and the council just openly said to him, we're not trying to make it more efficient, we're actually trying to make it more difficult for people to move across town in order that we move them away from personal car use. Now, if the people don't know about it, and the science isn't that important to those who are rolling it out, surely we should be questioning as a population, maybe this isn't the right course of action for us.
Because once it's established, it's established, it's going to be very difficult to overturn that. So what would that mean in practice? What would that mean for a lot of people, for example? Would it mean it would be easy to throw the caravan on the car and go up to the lakes, for example?
Well, again, we have to look at where this could lead. We're not saying it is leading there, but the reality is there is a huge possibility that if we continue to believe that carbon dioxide is the villain, and we follow the need for sustainable behaviour, which through nudge theory we're being conditioned to believe in and act accordingly, which is called sustainable behaviour, we need to understand that if we, for example, want to take the caravan, as you say, up to Hanmer, for example, and we've used our carbon dioxide allowances for this month to a point where we can't warrant that trip, or it's not seen as sustainable, it's not seen as sustainable behaviour to basically put petrol into our vehicle and drive up to Hanmer. The reality is what at the moment is seen as a decision that we can make could be taken out of our hands as we initially become, with the social credit system essentially, prejudiced for our decision to go to Hanmer. It could be enforced at some point, and if we refuse to comply, as you say, it could go from not being able to go to Hanmer to being told you have to take the next vaccine. And when you look at changes in definitions, which are really important because obviously we're being given things like thought leadership. Now, thought leadership, we're having our thoughts guided. And thought leadership is one of those terms being utilised by the Smart Cities Council, which, as I say, the Smart Cities Council Australia and New Zealand are also bringing in training the staff, for example, at our councils, in rolling out the Smart Cities programme. So this May, we actually in New Zealand have an Auckland-based celebration of essentially of the Smart Cities programme in New Zealand. And who's to say how quickly these things will progress? But the reality is we need to, as a population, simply wake up to the possibilities that this isn't going to work that well for us as a population in terms of our rights and freedoms and our ability to enjoy New Zealand.
The problem is that a lot of people will be thinking, nah, that won't happen, or I won't let that happen, stuff them, I'll go to the lakes if I want to go to the lakes. But look what happened with the lockdowns and then the vaccine passports. And what else also have you noted overseas? Because they have actually turned villages into smart cities, and it's actually really backfired, hasn't it?
Well, again, we can look overseas. Initially, I would say we just need to look at the way this could roll out. And obviously, when you look at the different terms, the different conditioning that our councils are now receiving, and the dates that relate to Agenda 2030, which again, people need to start to look at context, a history. So when you look at the Iron Mountain report, which was the first place really that many of us started to see, if we were aware of it, the concerns that we were being told about that relate to climate change, which initially started to fire up as global warming and then at times became climate change and then back to global warming, and we had all sorts of concerns that, you know, fear-based reasons that we need as a population to be less worried about world war and more worried about how the global the effect of humanity, mankind, on our environment is basically causing such severe problems in terms of climate change, experienced increased intensity of weather patterns, etc. Without looking at other possible reasons, we're told to be fearful of this. So from the Iron Mountain Report of 1967, I believe, we again, with United Nations input, we moved to the Brundtland Commission of 1983, which was set up in order to come up with an overall plan that we should all get behind, because it sounds really good. And by 1987, the Commission's name had changed to the name for the overall plan for us around the world, which became known as Our Common Future in 1987. And this became the new name for the actual committee as it rolled out what became the action plan for this century, which is called Agenda 21. It's a United Nations agenda. And again, you can read about this. It's open to interpretation. It's quite a large report, so most people won't take the time to read it. They don't want to make the time to read it, and that's understandable. But it's called the Agenda for the 21st Century. It's the action plan for our 21st century. It's the sort of thing we probably should know about. And then that basically, in its application on a local basis, so it's a global plan being applied on a local basis, became known as Agenda 2030 and Agenda 2050, where we're actually looking at, for example, the carbon dioxide allowances. So our council, for example, have stated that with their view of sustainable development, which was defined in Agenda 21 as the balance of social equity, environment and ecology, which is a nebulous balance, which of course all large organisations are now being asked to provide their own sustainable reports, you know, how they're approaching sustainability. And the reality is a lot of these things only make sense if you believe in climate science as it's being presented to us. So, as I say, the reality is when you look at the dates, our council have made themselves look even better in their own view based on their own underlying assumptions by saying that they will be carbon neutral by 2030, whereas the requirement essentially for them to be carbon neutral would be 2050.
So I guess we can see this unfolding. They're slowly installing, well, not even slowly, they're installing the 5Gs, they're installing the cameras, and even recently, I think they're letting us know, for example, the supermarkets, they're going to be doing facial recognition, so they're just feeding a little bit of information out there. Once that becomes all a reality, things might be fine, but then they'll stage some type of, you know, climate crisis. And then they're locked down. You're not allowed to go any further than 5 kilometres from your house. And they've got all that infrastructure there to actually lock us in, literally.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't buy into the fear. The idea is that these are possibilities once that system is in and people believe in the climate science. So the reality is, for example, as you said, with the lockdowns, the original lockdowns that we've been talking about the virus vaccine situation, if we look at Dr. Sam Bailey's work, which is as really, she's now alongside Mark Bailey, and now famous characters worldwide for their ability to look with objectivity at the data and to explain that fundamentally we haven't had a health crisis. Now this is stuff that where you talk to many people, including those in the medical area, doctors, nurses, many people can't question. And without that ability to question, we don't have an open mind. We don't know what we're going to learn next about anything. So we know nothing for sure. And when we keep that open mind and an open heart, we want what's best for the greater good. Now, in that place, as a doctor, for example, we could look at the change in definitions. So, for example, we look at the definition of a pandemic, which originally would have included, in the old definitions of yesteryear, the idea that you had to have significant sickness and a lot of deaths. Now, the new definition, of course, actually resolves on cases. Now, when you look at the PCR test, which is where we get our cases from, it's a polymerase chain reaction test, identifying tiny fragments of genetic material, we're focusing on the RNA in this case, at 35 cycles, the reality is that we're only dealing with one strand of RNA at that level. We're running the tests at 40 cycles and amplifying this material to the point where it really provides us with no information which could be used as a partial diagnostic or certainly as a diagnostic. And Kerry Mullis, who set the original tests, PCR tests up, he expressed, and this could be easily seen on video, huge concerns about the medical profession, essentially the pharmaceutical people, utilizing the PCR test as a partial diagnostic or diagnostic. The reality is it cannot prove you have a specific sickness. So we've got an in silico modeled genome that's never been found in nature. We've got a PCR test that can't identify a disease. We do have symptoms. So we then, as a population, need to, as Dr. Sam Bailey and so many others around the world are doing now, questioning what is this that we're looking at in terms of, is it a virus? Do viruses exist? And this is a huge area of study, but it's been simplified by Dr. Sam Bailey's work in Virus Mania, which is a great book for people to look at. If they want a more simplified version that really gets on top of things on an up-to-date basis, there's a book that's just come out, I think it's called The Last Pandemic, which Dr. Sam Bailey has published now. So that's basically available for purchase. Okay. And is a great book for people to clarify where we're at. Now, the fact is that when people took the vaccines, which no longer, as I say, need to provide any level of vaccine-induced immunity, many people are now saying, well, I wouldn't take another one. And so these are the people who originally believed that they were taking a vaccine. Now, if a vaccine no longer is attenuated or subunit as we used to have vaccines, the new mRNA technology that's being used, because it doesn't seem to have the capability to provide vaccine-induced immunity, clearly in our old world definitions, it's actually not a vaccine. So when we look at these basic facts and we question outside the medical model of just believing I'll take the vaccine because it gives me this improved level of immunity, when we start to question and we look at the seeming facts, we realize fear, simply false evidence appearing real, is actually quite easy to identify. And then as a community, we start to break down the walls of fundamental assumptions that aren't correct, ideas that are a result are not correct, and resistance to discussing the issues. So we start to create what we call community. And community is the answer to the problem. It's simply love over fear. But we have to be willing to be informed. We need to be open to the new information that people like Dr. Sam Bailey are providing us on a plate, having done thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of research alongside many others around the world, including microbiologists and others, exosomal scientists, all sorts of people who literally are creating a level of clarity where we've been led down maybe a path that would benefit a very small sector of the population that are seeking a power-based change from essentially at the moment America to China. So it's understanding the context of smart, carbon dioxide-free, 15-minute cities in this context of a slightly bigger picture where there are certain interested groups that are involved with organizations like the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, under which we had the Young Global Leaders Program, which Jacinda was obviously a part of, and the United Nations itself, where we're seeing a lot of fear-mongering and being told you can't question the underlying assumptions. So the underlying assumptions are really important because it's only those assumptions that give us the ideas that we have that give us a sense of worldview, which many of us at the moment are not quite there in terms of being able to question.
Mm. I really appreciate your comments. And before, you said you don't want to be basing things on fear. And the problem is we have so much information now, and it is actually really easy to be fearful from, you know, and the World Economic Forum themselves have been quite blunt about what they want to achieve. So that fear, it is very real. But this fear really needs to be motivate someone to be educated, motivate people to be aware of it, to talk to others, to create a community, to say no as a community. Would that be a fair enough comment? Because what is the actual solution?
Well, again, where you look at the facts, which literally is information. Now, the reality is true knowledge is the knowledge that we cannot know, which is why I've not answered your questions about motivation for those who are rolling these programs out. At the highest level, obviously, there is some form of agenda. And we've even got what we call Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, Agenda 2050. And I've talked to people within our councils who admit that this is Agenda 2030 that we're watching. And of course, this is why the carbon dioxide allowances actually relate to the year 2030, which is what you'll see come up again and again in the council information. So the reality that we're experiencing, as you say, It can be fear-based, but fear, in my understanding, simply, it's one of those few words that just speak it out. It's false evidence appearing real. And that's all we can seek to identify to gain truth. The reality is we cannot know the motives of those who are basically able to run governments from a shadow. We hear the term shadow government, but the reality is we are seeing organizations like the Smart Cities Council, which is a global organization, and we are looking at the same structure of the Smart Cities program being rolled out in England, in Germany, in France, in Canada, all these places where people who are in their specific compartmentalized level of information, which we call viewpoint, we are seeing them standing up in little communities. So in Canada, we saw the truckers, for example. Here, we've obviously had the farmers who stood up on occasion. We had the huge situation where the people literally were questioning the government and asking for a meeting at Wellington. And of course, we all know what happened there. There's many different viewpoints as to how it played out based on the propaganda that we see in the papers about a non-peaceful group of people who went up there. They had huge community support, but again, we watched as that was quelled and the reporting on it was very one-sided. So the reality is we have to be able to question. And so when we question, we gain insight. And with insight, we see our community action. And it needs to break down these borders of seeming knowledge. So where we think we know, we're always wrong because we don't know what we're going to learn next about anything. And so with an open mind and an open heart, we just simply want what is for the greater good. And in that place, we have community. And that's simply what it means with unity. And the fear is literally where we see the separation, which, if you look at our local politics, is incited fundamentally through government and other organizations which are projecting the interests of people that many people aren't yet aware of. So motive I would not get stuck on, but where we as a community are looking at things like the ways in which our buildings are now being structured, urban densification. In New Zealand, it really doesn't make any sense.
Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add about smart cities?
I think people need to be aware it's an area, including the vaccine virus situation, which of course is part of this same bigger picture. It's an area that we need to care about. Now, if we don't mind, it doesn't matter, many would say. The reality is many people haven't learnt to care yet, to the level where they're willing to do a little bit of research. And unlike early situation where we had the practice essentially for this under the World Health Organization event 201, which people can easily look up, which took place as a practice for this such a pandemic, where we look at Bill Gates and his speech, I think it was 2015, where he said we don't need to be fearful of world war. We really do need to be fearful of a coronavirus epidemic, he called it, instead of pandemic. Clearly, we're watching as this play is rolled out. And if we continue to comply without questioning, we won't gain the insight necessary for action. And action I would call compassion. It's courageous action as a community. It's not really worrying how many of us there are, because the reality is, as we all begin to care, and this is happening, we gain the support of community around us. But at some point, one person would have had to speak up and say, hang on a minute, some of this doesn't make sense to me. And this is where we're seeing amazing people like Dr. Sam Bailey and others who have stood up despite the fact that those around them are complying without questioning.
Well, thank you very much, Ross. That was really, really informative. And thank you for watching. And please leave a comment. What are your thoughts? What do you think we should do? Use the links below. And don't forget to tune in next time. Thanks for watching.
Counterspinmedia.com.